Welcome to Broad Appeal, the podcast that looks back at female-driven films from the not-so-distant past, sponsored by Fleshjack. I'm Sean.
And I'm Brian.
How you doing, Brian?
Did we get a sponsorship that I didn't know about?
This is optimism.
Darling, of all the episodes to bring up Fleshjack, the one about black lesbians is not the one to do. How are you doing, Sean?
I've got a bit of a cough.
Are you still super as always?
But I'm super as always.
Thanks
for reminding me.
Yeah.
And I am very, very excited about today's episode.
Yes, we have just read, both of us for the first time, a classic, The Color Purple.
C-O-L-O-R.
That's right, it's American. It's as American as apple pie and grits. It's The Color Purple by Alice Walker, beloved of all sorts of people for decades, including your patron saint, Hillary Clinton.
No way.
Don't you remember that? It was her first public appearance following the tragic events of the 8th of November. Yes, people saw her in the woods and all that, but she went to Broadway to see the musical of The Color Purple, and she got a standing ovation when she walked into theater.
And rightly so, she should have.
Yeah, because as we know, black women turned out in droves for Hillary.
And fucking white women ruined the fucking world. Thanks, bitches.
So, you and I have read The Color Purple, finally. I remember, I think the first time I ever heard the name Alice Walker was in high school. We read Their Eyes Were Watching God by Zora Neale Hurston.
Mm-hmm, which I've also read.
A wonderful book. I believe that Alice Walker wrote the introduction to the edition that we read. Because Alice Walker, in addition to being a novelist, she was an editor at Ms. Magazine, the feminist magazine, and she was a black feminist poet. So she kind of was a literary figure even before the publication of The Color Purple. But for whatever reason, I think I had this mistaken impression that it was either simplistic or dirty or something. I don't know. I knew there was lesbian sex involved, and I knew there was rape.
I'm always a bit wary about reading any African-American novel that possibly might be centered on just how awful these people's lives are rather than how they live themselves. More just depictions of suffering than anything, because, I mean, I think the black American experience is one that has been imbued with suffering. But to think that that's the only story that gets told to a white audience is often a bit infuriating for me.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because within the first few pages of this novel, some truly terrible things happen to the heroine, right? I mean, she's raped as a child by her father. She's impregnated. Mm-hmm. She's then essentially
separated from her sister.
Separated from her sister, given away to a husband who also beats her and treats her badly. She's told she's ugly. So what are you saying? There's something about the quality of the writing or the story that takes you past that? Is that what you're saying?
It's the vitality of the characters' lives, really. Especially the female characters. It's a novel that's not without pretty explicit violence and cruelties on every other page. But it's also about, you know, you think of the characters of Shug and Seeley and Squeak and, you know, all of them, you know? Like, there is a vitality to them.
I'm sure there's probably a lot of people listening to this podcast who are familiar with The Color Purple, but you want to just run down essentially what it's about and how the story is told?
The Color Purple is an epistolary novel, meaning that it's told in letters, a la Dracula.
Okay? A la Dangerous Liaisons.
Yeah.
Except that in this case, the letters are not written to anyone, at least not at first. Who are they written to?
They're written to God by Seeley, our main character. And it is written in vernacular, the way she speaks, which I think is terrific. I really love that about the book. It's melodious, it's natural, it's poetic, it's a beautiful style, and it's true to these characters' lives.
Seeley is a young woman, certainly not very educated. There's lots of discussion of her not really understanding kind of book learning. Mm-hmm. But she is expressing in her own deep but conventionally inarticulate way the pain and confusion that she feels at her life and the world around her. She's basically living, I think, in the era of sharecropping in the Jim Crow South. We first meet her when she's a very young girl.
Well, at the very start of the novel, Seeley is sexually assaulted by her father. We're led to believe her father.
Her mother dies.
Her mother dies. It results in two pregnancies of children that are then sent away. She's then separated from her sister and basically sold off, as it were, into marriage.
To add to the complications, the reason why the sister can't stay around, right, is because the sister is also being preyed upon by older men. Her sister, Nettie, runs away because she's also being the object of unwanted affections by the father, if memory serves, mm-hmm. and also by the man that Celie ends up marrying, whose name is?
Mister.
His real name is Albert, but for whatever reason, they call him Mr. Blank.
Yeah, with a space.
They just leave a blank space. I'm not sure why that is that way.
Yeah, I wonder too.
So Celie is kind of a drudge in this man's household, right? Like, he literally calls her ugly. He says she's not good for anything. He has sex with her, but in a very kind of robotic, unpleasant way.
He makes her work. He's ungrateful. He's horrible, basically.
As we're describing it, you're absolutely right. It makes it sad. And I think maybe this is what turned me off, thinking, oh God, this is going to be painful and terrible. But there is something about Alice Walker's prose and Celie's voice that has a kind of innocence and resilience and humor that carries you through, doesn't it?
Well, the thing about this book is because it's epistemological, is that right?
It may be epistemological, but it's also epistolary.
Okay, because it's epistolary and episodic at the same time, it does encourage you to read quickly.
I have to say, the book that it reminded me the most of, one of my other favorite women-centered novels, the novels of Elena Ferrante. I mean, because...
I can see it.
Do you see why? Because it is this very potent and powerful, deeply primal story about female relationships. Mm-hmm. It's very literary, but also incredibly readable, with a plot that's a bit like a soap opera. And the chapters are these kind of bite-sized bits that you just read one of them, and then you're like desperate to move on and read to the next. We flew through this book in the same way that I do with the Ferrante.
Well, what I was trying to say earlier... Yes. Was that even though you do read it speedily, some of the content is just so harrowing that you have to like close the book and be like, man, I can't take any more of this for a while.
Both of these female writers that I'm talking about in different contexts are talking about class relations, they're talking about patriarchy, deep bonds between women, but they're doing it with a story that's really accessible. She's writing about women's awakening and empowerment and coming into their own, their enlightenment. But she's telling it in this story that you're like, what's going to happen to Celie? What's going to happen to all these other characters?
But what is not as clear from picking up the book and reading the back of it, say, is that it's such a queer novel. I really mean that. We throw this word around all the time. But in this book, there are relationships between men and women and women and men, and the men watching the women have relationships with other women and hoping that the women will come back to them. There's a fluidic element of it. It's just not so clear-cut or one or the other.
Yeah, that's right. And at the center of that vaginal Venn diagram is a character that we haven't mentioned so far.
Yes, Shug Avery.
Yeah. Why is she named Shug?
Sugar.
So who is she? Who is Shug? Or Shug? Or Shug? Shug.
It's not Shug.
I know, it's spelled like Shug.
Would you say Sugar? Shug Avery is a singer, a traveling singer on the road, who sings in gin houses and bars.
Juke joints,
everything. She's glamorous, she's sexy, she's confident. And she has had a previous relationship with Mr., who she appears to have been in love with once. And, you know, just to show you the dynamic between interpersonal relationships, yes, Mr. is married to Celie. Does that make a bit of difference when Shug Avery comes to town? No. He shacks up with her in his own house with his wife.
And then, of course, it's not too long before Celie is also feeling stirrings herself, lesbian stirrings, for this other woman. And what's amazing is that Celie and Shug actually do develop a sexual relationship, and that actually she should be able to experience pleasure, because until she's, you know, basically an adult, Celie has never experienced sexual pleasure. Sex has only led to the burden of children. It's been a source of trauma. It's been a source of...
lack of agency.
Yeah, and just violence inflicted upon her by men.
And not unlike Fried Green Tomatoes at the Whistle Stop Cafe.
Yes, indeed.
There is a scene involving a mirror and a vagina.
Yeah, the famous button. And gradually, we discover Celie, like, dropping the trappings of the ideology in which she's been raised and kind of becoming an empowered free agent in her own life.
Both in terms of how she expresses herself sexually, her relationships with other people, and also financial agency as well.
Yeah, because she starts becoming an entrepreneur, making her own... Pantaloons. Yes. Do you want to read any bits of it?
I will read, and I'm prefacing it now by saying I am not doing the voices. But I am going to read what it says on the page as it is written.
It's
going to
be amazing with your lovely Irish lilt.
So in this section, Shug is talking to Celie about her body. And she's slightly laughing at Celie in a sweet, affectionate way about how clueless Celie appears to be. Here we go. Do his business, she say. Do his business. Why, Miss Celie, you make it sound like he going to the toilet on you. That would it feel like, I say. She stopped laughing. You never enjoyed at all, she asked, puzzled. Not even with the children, Daddy. Never, I say. Why, Miss Celie, she say, you still a virgin. What? I asked. Listen, she say, right down there in your pussy is a little button that gets real hot when you do you-know-what with somebody. It get hotter and hotter and then it melt. That's the good part. But other parts good too, she say. Lot of sucking go on here and there, she say. Lot of finger and tongue work. Button? Finger and tongue? My face hot enough to melt itself. She say, here, take this mirror and go look at yourself down there. I bet you never seen it, have you? No. And I bet you never seen Albert down there either. I felt him, she say. I stand there with the mirror. She say, what, too, shame even to go off and look at yourself. And you look so cute, too, she say, laughing, all dressed up for Harpo's, smelling good and everything, but scared to look at your own pussy. You come look with me while I look, I say. And us went off to my room like two prankish girls. You guard the door, I say. She giggle. Okay, she say, nobody coming, coast clear. I lie back on the bed and haul up my dress, yank down my bloomers, stick the looking glass between my legs. Ugh, all that hair. Then my pussy lips be black. Then inside look like a wet rose. It a lot prettier than you thought, ain't it, she say from the door. It mine, I say. Where the button? Right up near the top, she say. The part that stick out a little. I look at her and touch it with my finger. A little shiver go through me. Nothing much, but just enough to tell me that this is the right button to mash. Maybe.
There's lots of nipple sucking and kissing and all sorts of business that goes on for that. It's interesting, like, reading this and talking about it after our last episode of Carrie, where everything to do with the vagina and sexuality is so full of pain and shame. So much of the shape of The Color Purple is about women losing all forms of shame. And soon after that, basically it turns out that the separated sister, Nettie, who Celie is so in love with, has been off in Africa all this time because she's gone off with missionaries. And all these revelations come out that Mister has been hiding from Shug and from Celie. There's another really powerful turning point where Celie basically stops writing her letters to God because she basically says, God's done nothing for me. And again, this is Alice Walker also saying something about the black experience, and particularly the black female experience, that in a lot of ways, religion, Christianity in particular, are used to kind of justify this kind of suffering that black women have had to put up with. Oh, well, we suffer. This is all part of God's plan. Or, you know, we just have to bear these burdens. And Celie really shifts from believing in the goodness of God to really feeling that there's some kind of goodness that doesn't have to be a man who's a white man's vision of God.
Yeah.
And I guess if I have a issue with the novel, that does seem like a 70s and 80s feminist author.
Pop philosophy.
Yeah, well, not pop philosophy, but putting a very, very, very enlightened viewpoint into the mind of a young woman in the 20s and 30s in the Jim Crow South. But you know what? It works. And it's so validating as a story. And basically, we don't have to go through it. There's a whole long section where we get the letters that explain what have been happening to the sister who's gone away,
Nettie.
Well,
let's not forget that the children in which Celie had with her father were put up for adoption.
Yeah.
And were taken in by a slightly more affluent black couple who then became missionaries.
Yeah, they're like an evangelical minister.
So Nettie is over there to be basically be with Seeley's children.
As kind of their governess, and they're off in Africa. And then we have this whole other, like, political element in the novel, which is all about the relations between African Americans, the descendants of slaves, and the African people who remained in Africa, and we get colonialism. I mean, there's just so much to kind of unpack politically in this book. Lots of trials and tribulations happen, and how does it end?
Happily ever after.
It does. The sisters are reunited, even though Seeley doesn't end up with Shug, because Shug, in that wonderful free spirit way that she has, she kind of shifts between loving Seeley and loving a 19-year-old stud of a guy and going back and forth. I mean, Shug is my new role model, basically. I mean, don't we all want to live life like Shug?
Don't I already?
Shug and Sean, the names are not that dissimilar.
You're Sophia.
Now, we haven't mentioned Sophia. Who's Sophia?
Well, so this is the thing about the book. There are so many characters. Sophia is one of the sadder characters in the novel, I have to admit. Sophia is a driven, ballsy...
She's a kind of masculine, sort of Amazon-type woman who fights back against the patriarchy.
You know, who you're absolutely rooting for until her fighting back lands her in trouble with, of course, the white lawmakers, the mayor, and she ends up in a godforsaken prison hellhole.
And then eventually in a kind of servitude.
Yeah, to the white people in the
And she's community. Separated from her children as well.
She has one of the more inconclusive Circean stories, almost.
Circean how?
Well, she's reunited with her children, but they don't know her, basically.
Well, by the way that the entire novel plays out, she does end up back in the home and the bosom of family. Nettie returns with Seeley's children. You know, it's not unlike a Shakespearean story in that regard, in the sense that, like, what's been lost comes back, revelations come about, families are reunited as best they can be.
Yeah, I mean, for example, Sophia's husband, Harpo, now lives with another woman with whom he has children, and they all live together. So basically, the marriage setup, the family dynamic that they set up, is in contrast to what I would consider the Anglo-Saxon Protestant mentality of husband, wife, children, forever and ever, amen, till death do you part, okay? The structure of the family, you know, with different mothers, different fathers, it still becomes this one cohesive unit in which parenting takes different forms, and whatever it is theirs, and they make it work.
Well, and I think what's interesting is that in some ways, the negative aspects of that dynamic are very embedded in the legacy of slavery and forced separation and poverty and class.
Of course.
Which has forced all this kind of patriarchy and violence and poverty and disempowerment. And so that is probably the dominating force at the beginning of the novel that keeps separating everyone. But you're absolutely right. They make do by reconfiguring different forms of family relation throughout, beginning new relationships as time and circumstances allow, and a kind of acceptance of that, so that even at the end, Seeley and Mister have kind of
finally become friends.
Yeah, and pass through their difficulties.
Yeah, this is not a white bourgeois family. But so instead of fretting about what the neighbors are saying, they just, as you said, I think the word reconfigure is very pertinent.
And that's also an aspect of its queerness. Yeah. So when I say to you the words, you know, clitoris, black American experience, lesbianism, colonialism, I think, you know, naturally you think, who best to tell this story but Steven Spielberg? So we're gonna watch the 1980s adaptation of this film. We have not ever seen it. It was nominated for 11 Academy Awards.
How many did it win, Brian?
It won 0. It's a record holder. If memory serves, it's tied with The Turning Point.
Oh, no.
The Anne Bancroft...
also about lesbianism.
Yeah. In the ballet. Anyway, as far as I know, those two movies had the record for the most number of nominations without a single win. That might have been matched recently by... Might have been American Hustle.
Yeah. I don't think American Hustle had 11, but I do know that it wouldn't have.
Well, American Hustle, yeah. Anyway, so I've been doing a little bit of reading about The Color Purple when it came out. The novel was obviously popular. It won the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Award, but it was nowhere near have the cultural reach that the film did. However, the film was super controversial. Now, if you asked me, I would have assumed that the reason it was controversial was because you had this white man directing a black female story. No. I was like reading New York Times articles and reviews and stories. It was all over the talk show circuit at the time. It was not about the inauthenticity of this. I guess because in the 80s, first of all, there weren't that many prominent female directors, let alone black female directors. It was maybe just kind of assumed that if it was going to be a Hollywood movie, it would have to be directed by a white man. The controversy was that the story of The Color Purple painted black men in a terrible light. I found all these think pieces from the New York Times and elsewhere where black men, including people like Spike Lee and lots of academics and talk show hosts, were saying the only reason this novel is successful, particularly successful among the white cognoscenti, is because it's all about shitting on black men. Wow. Yeah. So there is so much. There's such a thorny political dynamic to unpack here.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to seeing this. Isn't it just so funny though, Brian? Okay? Like, you and I are woke enough, okay?
Yeah, you know, reasonably.
We're reasonably woke. You know, we're not super
woke. We could always wake up more.
We could.
We get woker.
Okay,
but we could wokeify.
But we're not super duper woke, okay?
We're at least aware, you know, like Socrates, who is the wisest man in the world because he realizes how little he knows. I think at least we're aware of our privilege and aware of how far we have to go.
We're at a Socratic level of wokeness. Okay,
We'll put it that way.
But can you imagine today how we, as white cisgendered men, how we would react if we heard that this novel was being made for the first time?
I mean,
the internet
would be off the charts.
We would be like, what the fuck are you talking about? Because the thing is,
I mean, if it was like, and Scarlett Johansson is playing Celie.
The way I see it, anybody can write about anything they want. I'm not about limiting frames of reference or imagination. Okay, that's my first point. But my second point is that there are enough goddamn stories told by white men in this world, okay?
Yeah.
The point is, anybody can tell a story, but there are certain stories that need to be told by certain people with a certain frame of reference and viewpoint of the world. And this is one of those stories. It would have been amazing if it was directed by a black person, at least. And a black woman, obviously, would be much better.
Well, and I'm going to go even further to this, which is to say, if you're going to employ a white male film director to do this, Steven Spielberg is perhaps the strangest choice.
Yeah, I completely agree.
I mean, this story is full of darkness and pain, as we said, as well as joy, right?
Yeah.
But in particular, it's full of sensuality and sexuality. I mean, just think, Sean. Think about all the Steven Spielberg movies that have ever been made.
Yeah.
Do any of them have a memorable, horny, or arousing, pleasurable sex element at all?
Do any of them, in fact?
Any of them. Can you think of a sex scene in a Steven Spielberg movie? The only one I can think of is in Munich.
Are you serious?
There's a scene toward the end of Munich, which is one of the most maligned elements of that whole movie, where Eric Bana is fucking his wife while having like traumatic flashbacks about his experience as an Israeli assassin.
Do you see his ass, at least?
I don't remember, but it's really like it's not a pleasurable scene. I mean, I guess arguably there's a fun, playful, sexual tone to something like Catch Me If You Can, but really, Steven Spielberg, for all his many, many talents, is sort of an asexual director and a kind of a juvenile director. And certainly, right at this time when this movie was made, he was known as a wunderkind, but for like whiz-bang, gee-whiz, sci-fi fantasy.
Sci-fi,
right? Like
sharks.
E.T., sharks, kind of you know, Close Encounters, Indiana Jones. And I want to say, I am a fan of Steven Spielberg. And I am also a fan of Steven Spielberg's recent work. I went out on a limb with people. I would tell people to go to see Bridge of Spies.
You were a one-man marketing campaign.
I loved Bridge of Spies.
You were for Bridge of Spies, but I was for Elle. Writing emails to people, you know, cold calling.
I just said to them, would it help? But, like, there is something to me about the sort of eminence grise that Steven Spielberg has become in the last 10 to 15 years.
Well, I think he became that after Schindler's List.
There are plenty of Steven Spielberg's civics lesson films that I don't think are great. I was not a fan of Saving Private Ryan. I mean, the technical achievement of that D-Day landing scene is amazing, but to me the rest of the movie is tepid and banal. Amistad, lots of problems
with
that.
Let's go there.
But there's something around the time that he made Lincoln. I just love these, like, American stories that he kind of wants to tell. And they really do feel like, in some ways, films that are made for, like, a high school history class. Like, I will absolutely acknowledge that. But they're made with passion and verve and some complexity. So, if you sit down and you watch Munich and you watch Bridge of Spies and you watch Lincoln, I think you'll have so much to say about citizenship.
That's a very nice way to put it, Brian.
Yeah, and I think they're really interesting films. The Color Purple is not that, yeah. Right? Like, The Color Purple is, as a novel, is definitely about some of the fundamental injustices of American society, of colonialism, of relations between the sexes. But, like, those are not the issues that Steven Spielberg is typically adept at handling.
What I have issue with before we even see the film is that I know this is a PG-13 film.
In fact, it was the first PG-13 film ever nominated for an Oscar.
Are you kidding me?
I'm not kidding you.
You mean Gremlins 2 didn't get a nomination. Okay, but the thing is, it's like, oh God, why? What are you trying to tap into the teenage boy audience? What I'm worried about is that the violence is depicted, but the sensuality is not.
We did actually watch the trailer. I have to say, so like all...
Oh my God, I'm so glad you mentioned this.
All of our fears were...
Confirmed.
Ratcheted up by this trailer. I mean, I don't know if this was the real trailer's recent release in theaters. First of all, it has that 80s thing. What happened to, like, people narrating trailers? You never get that now, but it's that... First of all, it seems like that typical white man trailer guy who's like... The Color Purple is a story about people. I think that's literally what it says. It's a story about people. You're like, oh, great. So it's not a story about, like, extraterrestrials. It's a story about people. Universal people that you'll love.
It's like, we welcome to the screen your favorite characters. And then it goes, Mr. Old Mr. And it's like, yeah. Start the trailer with the most aggressive, hateful motherfuckers in the book.
Yeah, the ones who, like, you know, beat and abuse women. Yeah. And there's, like, Hallmark Hall of Fame, like, kind of chintzy music.
And Danny Glover is sweetly smiling to the camera.
And it's like, you'll never forget Shug and Sophia. But, like, clearly this is whatever studio released the film.
Warner Brothers.
They're projecting this movie to white audiences with that trailer. From what I've read... It's been a huge touchstone with black female audiences, mm-hmm. you know, when it came out and since then. And obviously now the Broadway musical, which has been revived a couple of times, is driven by the response that black women have to this story, as well they should. I mean, it should be said that Quincy Jones, the black music producer and film personality, was a producer of this.
True.
Oprah is in the film. And I mean,
you mean Academy Award nominee Oprah Winfrey?
Yes, for this.
I know.
Yeah, but also she produced the stage version as well. So, you know, it's definitely a classic of black female storytelling. The question, I guess, is wanting to get this story told, wanting to get this story in front of the eyes of as many people as possible. Has it been forever compromised by watering it down? And I guess we'll have to wait and see.
Before we even watch the film, which we're about to do... I am going to go out on a limb here and say that The Color Purple is a film that lends itself to a remake.
In a similar way to the way that we said about The Handmaid's Tale.
Yeah.
Well, it's been remade as a musical. Mm-hmm. Maybe it'll be a musical remake. Maybe they'll do the musical version.
It better be explicit.
I know this movie has a very checkered reputation. I have a feeling there's going to be some strong elements, some elements that we are left scratching our head.
And have we even mentioned Whoopi Goldberg?
We have not mentioned the amazing Whoopi Goldberg in her film debut.
When you see Whoopi win her awards for this film early on...
She won the Golden Globe for Best Actress in a Leading Role.
Yeah. It is a Whoopi with a rough edge to her that I feel... became smoother as she became Hollywood royalty herself.
Whoopi Goldberg's career trajectory is so unlike anyone else, isn't it? I mean, she's a kind of young, spunky New York stand-up comic, really. And her material is kind of edgy and provocative. This film, it's a very prestige, kind of noble picture. And then we were looking at Whoopi's filmography soon after that. I mean, it's straight from this to, like, Jumpin' Jack Flash and, like, all sorts of, like, trashy crime comedies.
Well, they didn't know what to do there.
But I guess...
I would want to watch Fatal Beauty, though, quite soon.
I mean, there's plenty of all sorts of whoopee things of all different kinds of levels we can watch. And she definitely can play that noble character. I mean, we saw her in Girl Interrupted in our first season, and she's certainly done things like Karina, Karina. I have to say, you know, one time before I met you, Sean, I was approached by someone on OkCupid, and he seemed nice. He seemed perfectly great. But I just could not go on a date with someone whose favorite film was Karina, Karina.
Are you serious?
I just could not deal with it. I was like, this is a bad sign.
I mean, mate, have you seen Theodore Rex? You could pick something better.
Someone whose favorite film was Theodore Rex, I would be out the door, desperate to meet him. But Karina, Karina, Ray Liotta, and Whoopi Goldberg?
But, you know, here's a shout-out to Alan Flanagan and to Riazzi's Chip Shop / Video Store in Amesbury County, Longford.
Yeah.
I swear to God, I stared at the VHS box as a child to Theodore Rex and thought, what the fuck is this?
If anybody doesn't know what we're talking about, Theodore Rex is a police comedy in which Whoopi Goldberg's partner is a 6-foot-tall animatronic dinosaur. I think we have to leave it there, Sean, yeah. Because... spoiler alert, we may come back to Theodore Rex in the future, but right now we're talking about one of the great works of African-American literature. So we love Whoopi, and I'm eager to see her in this dramatic role. How about Oprah?
Whenever I see Oprah on screen, I'm like, that's Oprah. You know what I mean?
I'm pretty sure that when The Color Purple came out, she was a known talk show host
in Chicago,
but I don't think the Oprah show had gone national yet, so she was not the Oprah that we came to know. So she's this amazing media figure. She's done these occasional film roles. They almost always seem to have a really strong interest in documenting the black female experience. Like, she did this, she did Beloved. She's
with another white man directing that.
But she produced it and starred in it. I mean, she's always championed black female literature on the book club.
Don't forget The Butler.
Yeah. No matter what happens to me, everything that I could do, everything that I am, I'll never forget That Butler.
That's not even remotely the line. Not even remotely.
I know, it's not. Now that she's not got her show anymore, she's acting a lot more.
Oprah has her own network, Brian. She has her own show.
Yeah, she has her network and her magazine and her media empire. But what I'm saying is she's doing a lot more acting. She's going to be in Ava DuVernay's Wrinkle in Time. Of course, she was in Selma for Ava DuVernay. And we just saw that she's going to take the Shirley MacLaine role in a Lee Daniels-directed remake of one of my favorite films, Terms of Endearment.
Yeah, we just saw that.
That is bonkers.
I'm really looking forward to that. Wonder, will she be in a remake of my favorite film, Postcards from the Edge? I'd be interested in that.
Maybe
Raven Simone can play the Meryl Streep character.
I would actually like to see a thing where Oprah Winfrey just remakes every single Shirley MacLaine movie, so we can get like Guarding Tess with Oprah Winfrey. What else can we get? The Apartment.
The Trouble with Harry. With
Steel Magnolia. You know who else? Another famous black female media personality who has a small role in this film, Sean.
Gail King.
That's right, the amazing Gail. She plays Churchgoer.
Okay.
According to Wikipedia. So are we ready? We haven't talked about what the title means.
It's about God.
You know, purple was my favorite color when I was young.
Color of Catholic royalty.
Easter. Is it Easter?
Easter.
Yeah, so Easter's just passed. Makes it entirely appropriate that we watch it now. All right. Steven Spielberg, do your worst. It's time for The Color Purple.
You always covering up your smile. Show me some teeth. Show me that pretty smile. Oh, girl, you need a smiling lesson. Come on.
Yes.
You see, Miss Seeley, you got such a beautiful smile.
Brian, I have to ask you, was Steven Spielberg truly the only person who could have directed this film?
Supposedly, Steven Spielberg directed Yentl. If that man directed Yentl, then perhaps that man also directed this simplified piece of pablum.
Yeah, pablum.
It's food for babies. This is the
film equivalent of a vol-au-vent.
What does that mean? Is it some form of pastry?
It's a very light puff pastry that usually contains mushrooms therein.
No, but that's the thing. This doesn't even contain mushrooms.
Yeah, the vol-au-vent doesn't contain mushrooms initially.
Mushrooms are savory, you know. Mushrooms have some kick and spice. And except for a few moments, I have to say, look, this movie, when not offensive, is boring.
Embarrassing, I would say.
Or simple-minded.
Or tedious.
Now, we found an interview that Spike Lee gave. Interestingly, his debut as a director with She's Gotta Have It was just a little while after this. And he is unembarrassed to really call out everyone involved in The Color Purple. He spares no criticism of Whoopi and Oprah and everyone. But I think one of his more astute points is that he says, look, what is the deal with a director as talented as Steven Spielberg making a movie as clumsy as this? He has no relationship to this material. He's making all these choices to regularize and commercialize this book.
For largely a white audience.
Or at least for an audience that's not looking to be challenged. They're simplifying and rubbing off all the rough edges of this. Now, does that mean that there aren't some nicely composed shots? Sure, there are. But the thing is, Spielberg, the lover of movies, the self-referential kind of Hollywood kid, seems to mostly be making this film saturated with other images of movies set in the South. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean ones that he should be referencing here. Shots that sometimes seem straight out of Gone with the Wind, or like an old Uncle Remus picture or something. I mean, we're talking Black American stereotypes all over the map.
Yeah. There was points where, early on, I was having these alarm bells. I turned to you to qualify how I was feeling, being like, this isn't right, is it? This is ridiculous. This is simplistic. It was saccharine. Like, I don't believe that you have to have some great fidelity to the original source material of anything you're adapting. However, what this film is of this book is not a different medium or realization. It's reductive.
Well, yeah, look it up. But in some ways, it's perhaps overly faithful to the letter of the book. I mean, up until some stuff towards the end, there's not really that much that's depicted in the film that's not somewhere in the book, right? It's just, I don't read The Color Purple and think of it as a childlike book.
Absolutely,
even though,
no way.
Even though it begins when Seeley is very young, Spielberg obviously is known for his childlike wonder. At that time, in the 80s, he was, in terms of the gee whiz fantasy, like telling E.T. from the story of these children who are without parents. Spielberg at that time is considered to be the boy who never grew up. It's also why he made that disastrous film of Peter Pan.
I quite
the
like
one
that
with,
film.
Anyway, it was a box office disaster. But do you know what
but
I mean?
But blame Julia Roberts for that.
What I'm just saying is that childlike wonder here is just curdled, and it's as if it's someone looking at some of the darkest material in human behavior and just presenting it in this kind of like, oh, isn't that bad sort of way. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Or kind of like, this stuff is just all too icky for me. I'm going to tell it through a happier version.
You don't want it to seem like they're making the life of the Jim Crow South seem unrelentingly miserable.
No.
But they live in these big, spacious, production-designed houses. Like, do you know what I mean? Seeley is beaten by Danny Glover. The rape, the birth, all of the events, the separation of the sisters, they're all depicted, but it's all been kind of honeyed by the look and the tone and the music.
Oh, my God.
It's not John Williams.
This music was Quincy Jones. It felt like a knockoff of the E.T. and Jurassic Park music.
Or even just some bad, like, Little Rascals short from the 1950s.
It was whimsical and sweet.
Clinky-winky and comic.
Like, oh, aren't these people's lives cute?
You know what? At one point, I don't know, have you ever been to Disney World? No, you've never been to Disney World.
No.
The bits where, like, everybody's going to, like, the local juke joint that Harpo has built and all the stuff. It just struck me as, like, the Song of the South Disneyland theme park version of the Jim Crow era.
Yeah.
There's a hotel that I can remember that's, like, the Bayou-themed hotel in Disney World somewhere in Orlando, Florida, that I once stayed at with my family when we went there. And that is what this seems like.
You also remarked that every scene has about 35 people in it.
Yeah, I
don't... All marching in tandem, swaying their arms, smiling toward the camera.
I haven't seen that many extras used clumsily since Felita Lloyd's direction of Mamma Mia. Okay, before we just trash this completely, are there any images or moments from the film that work for you? And I'll start with one. So we begin with a shot of the two young girls, Celie and Nettie, when they're children. We see them kind of playfully gambling idyllically in the field of the purple flowers. And you're like, oh, what are we in for here? It's this kind of Hallmark-y type young girls, you know, viewpoint. We can only see their heads. And then when they walk out from the tall grass and the color purple flowers, we see that Celie is big from being pregnant. If there had been more shots like that, shots that had true cinematic force, that were like charging you with discovery. Another one, much later in the film, Oprah's character, Sophia, when she's really been broken and they were referring to her as a nearly dead woman, there's a very, very brief shot where there's everyone sitting at a dinner table and she's staring into this plate. Do you remember this shot?
Of course, yeah.
And her face is kind of warped in this reflection in the plate that's kind of turned her into an almost inhuman sort of gargoyle. If only this movie had had more of these representations that balance the pain in and find a visual language that's striking to kind of convey that idea. But those moments were few and far between.
Perhaps my biggest issue with the film is tonally, because you can't wait for a film to shift in tone to get better. So when you're watching all these saccharine little pity-pat, patty cake girls playing. Like, this is the thing about Celie and her sister that kind of annoyed me. In the book, they go through these hardships. They take care of each other. They look after themselves. They don't spend their time running around sunflower fields playing patty cake, which is all they seem to do the goddamn time they're together. Which is how the film both begins and ends.
Yeah, and it's repeated regularly to kind of show their symbiosis.
Symbiosis is not done with the rhythmic clapping of hands.
I mean, that is a stereotype of young black girls, right? If it was slightly more modern times, they'd be like doing double dutch with jump ropes, but instead they're doing this like hand jive clapping thing or whatever it's called, patty cake. It's literally like they had a checklist. Let's have a gospel choir. Let's have some clapping. Let's have some African music. I mean, I don't know like how they thought they could get away with some of these tropes that aren't anywhere in the book.
Yeah, so by the time the film gets into its third act and, you know, Celie is obviously older and she's developed a personality and confidence, I feel that Whoopi Goldberg has much more to do. She has much more agency. I understand having a passive character, okay? But Celie, she doesn't even stand out in the film, you know, for two-thirds of it. And that's not fair to the character. In the novel, she's the narrative force behind it. In this, she pales in a way that is detrimental to the film.
Celie is our narrator in the novel, right? So we are in the presence of her voice. We're very intimate with her. Whereas the film, looking at Celie, all we're going to see is a quiet, mousy, withdrawn woman, because that is who she is until she discovers her voice. I mean, if you look at a film like Moonlight, similarly, Chiron, in his many different guises in Moonlight, is a similarly withdrawn, inarticulate character. Think about how we're drawn intimately through the cinematography of that film, through the editing, to see and feel things the way that boy and that man are seeing and feeling things. And we don't
get it with Celie, no.
No.
Another thing that is highly diluted, the button has been plucked from this story. Not even a hint, not a mention of a button.
This movie is rated PG-13. If you were, I don't know, 12, 13, would you even have understood that Seeley and Suge were sexual lovers?
Why would a 12-year-old need to see this film?
I know, I'm just saying, but like, okay.
Why are they the demographic?
Let's say you were anyone, would you have understood that?
In this version, no.
I mean, it's well acted between Whoopi Goldberg and Margaret Avery, but you see these two actresses, I think, literally trying to imbue some sense of what they remember from the book, the charge, and they can't.
No.
Because they've been written and directed to kind of skirt around it evasively. I mean, it begins with Suge saying something so banal to Seeley. She's like, Miss Seeley, you never smile. You need a smiling lesson. And I'm just like, oh my God, if this movie is only about smiling. I mean, that section that you read to us, that's that scene. I mean, she's saying to her, look at your pussy.
Yeah.
Like, touch your button.
But you know
what
else?
It's not about smiling.
The relationship between Suge and Seeley is depicted in other ways as well, like them just sharing a bed together, putting their arms around each other. There's a build-up to all this as well.
None of that is in the film.
And there's no reason why they couldn't have included that. Like, just to harp on about the rating for a minute, okay? This film should not have been marketed to anyone below the age of 16, because this is an adult's film, an adult story.
But I would actually argue that they did not try to make an adult film.
No,
but
what
I'm saying
is,
they tried to make a film for middle school students.
But what I'm saying is, they should have made a film for adults. That is probably largely due to the Steven Spielberg effect.
Or at least to the studio's perhaps discomfort with a lot of the material that they thought was maybe too racy, maybe too provocative.
Too black.
Too black. I mean, just to dwell ever so slightly on the end of that sex scene. Okay, so they're pecking at each other's cheeks, like they're smiling. I was like, is this ever going to get sexy at all? And then Whoopi and Margaret Avery do start to kiss on the lip.
It's Seeley putting her hand on Suge's back.
But then it pans to an inanimate object for some motif that I cannot understand. Okay, I get why they have the purple flowers. That's in the title. They pan away to a wind chime. I mean, what was that about? Since when, even in, like, you know, the movies of the 1930s, like, I don't think a wind chime was a stand-in for sex. And wind,
a dream catcher.
Wind chimes keep recurring. There's about four instances of wind chimes appearing, including near the very end, when Nettie and the children return from Africa. We get more fucking wind chimes. It wasn't called The Colors of the Wind, Purple. I mean, I don't know what that was about.
Yeah. Okay. One other issue that I had, I would turn to you and say, this is not right. And at one point, you very firmly said, this is a minstrel show. And Brian, I know that's a bit of a controversial thing to say. It felt at times like a minstrel show. I felt sorry for these actors at some parts.
Can we drill down into that a little bit? What specific moments and what elements are you saying had that uncomfortable element of minstrelsy?
There was a huge amount of slapstick.
A lot of it from the male characters. I could see them sitting around in the studio meeting saying, these male characters rape and beat most of the women. We have to make them somewhat more accessible and likable. Let's have them, like, bumble around with, like, horse saddles and, like, fall through roofs.
Try
and,
to,
like,
make breakfast.
And burn some biscuits. What it ends up being is creating these step and fetch it stereotypes of just smiling black men who are either depicted as predatory or depicted as buffoons.
Yeah, benign buffoons. We know in the book that Mister has control of all the letters arriving at the house, okay? Which in itself is quite a menacing idea, you think about it. But in the film, Mister runs out to the mailman, and at one particular point, he runs out with a plate of cookies.
Subserviently.
It's like, can I just say, cookies are a stand-in for the lamest, whitest bullshit. Cookies are both delicious and pathetic. Baking cookies, it's one of the worst things a human can possibly do.
Almost every turn to comedy in this film was not funny, and it curdled with, I think, a really tone-deaf sense of certain racial stereotypes. I mean, a person who's really poorly served by this comedy and who fights against it valiantly is Oprah.
All my life I had to fight. I had to fight my daddy, I had to fight my uncles. I had to fight my brothers. Girl child ain't safe in a family mint. But I ain't never thought I had to fight in my own house. I loves Hopper. God knows I do. But I kill him dead before I let him beat me.
The character of Sophia,
she's large.
She's large, she stands up, she's forceful, right? I mean, so we have all the comic business of her and Harpo falling down, and I mean, really, you would think Sophia is just there to be a kind of shrew type character, right? Mm-hmm. It's a bit like, you know, the Jim Crow version of like the Honeymooners or something. Mm-hmm. I don't know. And then we have this incident where she hits the mayor, which again, we don't see because Spielberg films it in this weird way.
I don't know why. So
describe it.
In many ways, I think Sophia, in the book at least, is a character who's reacting to this great amount of like systematic pressure that's been put on her, and she releases like a kettle. But Sophia, the character in this, kind of just blows off steam willy-nilly when she feels like it. Oh no, here comes Sophia. So when she does in fact hit the mayor, we see her like draw back her fist, and then a car drives by, and then the mayor's on the ground. And I'm thinking, why on earth did this scene have to be censored?
Sophia's plotline in the book is definitely the strongest, most dignified, most powerful representation of the confrontation of a black woman against the white patriarchy, right?
Like, yeah. And she's the one who has the relationship to the white community in the story.
And the weirdest thing about what they've done with the screenplay, that happens, she's put in jail, and then literally there's a cut to something that's meant to be 8 years later, and we're supposed to feel the weight of her having been in jail for 8 years and being separated from her kids. On a narrative level, how are you going to feel the weight of 8 years when literally a second has gone by?
Her hair was gray.
Her hair was gray. The Oscar-nominated makeup. I mean, let's just say there were a lot of really weird choices.
Okay, but just to show you another weird choice about Sophia, it's her altercation with Squeak. Now, the way I saw it in the book was that, remember, she knocks one of Squeak's teeth out, you know? It's pretty horrible. In this one, all the men quickly excuse themselves because they know there's a fight's coming on because Miss Sophia is here.
Whoop, time to go.
When she punches Squeak, she somehow falls into, like, a cellar full of water.
Well, because they're over a bayou
I guess, yeah.
And then suddenly all the Felidaloid extras
every
just
single
started,
person starts fighting.
It becomes a, like, hoedown and a ruckus and a rumpus.
And that is just so, I found that embarrassing.
It is. I will say there's another well-executed shot which conveys force. I think it's striking in terms of how different it is from everything else that you're describing, which doesn't work. Towards the end, after that dinner scene where Celie finally speaks up for herself and she says, I'm going to Memphis with Suge. They get out into the car. Mister is coming running at the car and he's about to slap Celie. And Whoopi just takes her hand and almost as like a sorceress holds out her hand and stops him.
And you notice one finger is kind of slightly crooked, the other one is pointed forward with this sort of incantation style about it.
Who you think you is? You can't curse nobody. Look at you. You're black, you're poor, you're ugly, you're a woman, you're nothing at all.
You do right by me. Everything you even think about gonna fail.
I love that part in the book where she says, I hex you, because it's quite powerful.
And as they drive away, she says, I'm poor, black, maybe even ugly, but dear God, I'm here. Those moments of power, of which there are some, it's too little too late in this film. You said when we were watching it that you thought Oprah was the standout here.
There are comic elements of Sophia. Like, she's this quite brusque, big woman. She has that hot-tempered quality about her. There's a dignity in her performance. And then we're told that something terrible has happened. So she really stops becoming that big, showy character. She's big in terms of her figure, but she's small and meek in terms of what's happened to her. And I love that about Oprah's performance.
It's interesting. Oprah must have been quite young when this was made, right? Like, how old do we reckon she was?
Well, it's 34 years ago now. Say Oprah's 60. at least 60. So take away 34 from that makes her 26.
That's the thing about her in this film is, like, she has that quality that you see sometimes in character actresses, where when they're young, they almost seem too young to be playing the roles that they are, but you know that they're going to grow into the gravitas that they have. Mm-hmm. She's clearly a young woman who has a kind of raw presence and force. She's not a very trained actress, and she doesn't really know what she's doing. But of course, she's going to become a media mogul and an amazing presence in so many ways in all of our lives. And now I think when you see Oprah in a movie these days, she just has so much more confidence and kind of ability to control the performances that she's giving. And you're right. You do see that in The Color Purple. The other two Oscar-nominated performances from this film are Whoopi, of course. We talked a bit about her. Did you think this did anything for her? I mean, did it use any of Whoopi's talents?
Well, it reaffirmed my belief that she deserved that Oscar for Ghost, because it is a role that gives her so much more to do. As Miss Seeley being all cute and smiley and, like, awkward and stuff, it's like, yeah, it's not your fault. It's the way this character has been drawn for you.
But again, I don't think I read the book thinking Miss Seeley is cute and smiley and
infant.
Like, she sometimes seems she's infantile.
Completely, completely.
Yeah. Margaret Avery, famously, this is a bit of Oscar trivia that we looked up. She's one of the most famous examples of a person who really, really campaigned for her Oscar nomination. She took out a full-page ad in Variety where she wrote in a really weird Black Southern Jim Crow era dialect saying, like,
Dear God, I
is shug and I is hoping to get nominated. It's literally one of the most bizarre episodes.
Margaret,
ever.
Have you read the book? It's not your character that does this.
That talks that way, I know. Margaret Avery is someone that I don't really know much else about her. What did you think of her as Shug?
Well, I looked at her filmography after this film, and it has to say, it's not so hot.
She's fine. I mean, she's a Bessie Smith kind of sex pot. She sings, but Shug is such a charismatic, sparky character in the book.
She did not stand out for me.
No.
No, she did not. She also had a lame subplot involving her father, the pastor.
Oh, we have to talk about this. This was the most Mamma Mia moment of the whole thing.
Ugh.
So they clearly felt that the ending, which is already, it has to be said, contrived, but you could see the studio executives be like, we need to lather on even more redemption for everybody. So I don't know if you were watching this, because I think you were getting so bored you started tweeting and looking away from the film.
Yeah, I may have.
But
just for a minute.
At this point, so Seeley has gone off to Memphis, and we know that Nettie is maybe or maybe not coming back from Africa. She started her business making the breeches for everybody. But this is only after another bit, which involves Shug's reconciliation with her father, the preacher, who doesn't respect her for being a slut.
Okay.
She has a series of scenes in which she tries to reconcile with her father, the preacher. He kind of shuns her for being, you know, singing the devil's music and all this stuff. And then, did you even understand what was meant to be going on in that scene? What happened?
Yeah, so what's happening is she's singing in the Duke joint, which is a stone's throw away from the church. How convenient. They're singing, and
in the gospel choir.
The gospel choir is singing. Then there's kind of like a little battle to drown out either side. Shug tells her guys to put down the weapons, their musical instruments. Then she starts singing along to what they're singing in the church. Then they all move en masse, all marching like the dwarves going home from work, smiling toward the camera.
A huge throng of people from the Juke joint.
Yeah, all walking.
Literally every cast member that's been in the film is in this scene.
Yeah. They walk into the church, they walk straight up to Dad, sing along to God and see, look, Dad, even sinners have souls too.
I know, and so
it's
suddenly
like, oh,
the church people and the jazz people are brought together, and then we move right from that reconciliation into the reconciliation of the two sisters finding each other again. And it's just like watching a fucking parade go by. Just, again, Disney World.
Does every person need a goddamn redemption, you know? I'm just really, really disappointed.
It really feels like the work of someone at odds with the material or confused by what he's trying to do. All of his natural abilities just have flown out the window.
Now, we went to see a film called Nothing But a Man at Christmas at the BFI.
Which was part of the
BFI Black Star season. But this film was made in the 60s, and it, admittedly, it was also directed by a white, possibly Jewish man, but it feels real. It is sweet where it needs to be. It is tough and hard and vicious where it has to be. So much more accomplished than this picture.
That film, Nothing But a Man, if our listeners have not heard of it, find it any way you can. It's an amazing movie. And it actually would make, I think, a fascinating double feature with The Color Purple, because you remember it is about a man and a woman and their complicated marriage, where the social pressures, both from religion and sexual mores of the time, being kind of working class people in a small southern town, as well as the pressures from the white community around them, infiltrating on their domestic lives. But it's just told with so much more subtlety and nuance and shades of emotion. What a beautiful, beautiful film.
But what that film underscores is that you cannot blame the 80s for The Color Purple. Like, a film like Nothing But a Man was made, admittedly it wasn't made by a huge studio, okay?
No.
Like, we can't just say, oh, it was the 80s, it was a different time, oh,
no, it's commercial filmmaking that's taking everything through a kind of meat grinder and churning out, like, material that lacks all specificity. And even from an artist who has a great track record, Steven Spielberg, of being an artist of commercial filmmaking, it'd be interesting to know if he directed The Color Purple today. I still don't think he'd be the right person to do it, but would it have been better than this effort? Probably.
Yeah. The final verdict is that the book is amazing and you should read it.
Watch Nothing But a Man. Skip the Steven Spielberg Color Purple.
There's a reason why it didn't win a single Oscar. Although I would have given it to Oprah.
Over Angelica Houston.
I haven't seen Pretty's Honor. But come on, Angelica Houston had, like, a slight advantage.
Hollywood royalty.
Hollywood royalty!
Now, we didn't like this movie very much. The film that's coming up next week is probably the film that Sean and I have been the most excited to watch since we first conceived of this podcast series. It also, however, is probably a film that almost none of you have heard of.
Yes, and it will probably be even more maligned than Dead Again.
What is that film, Sean?
That film is Slaves. This is Slaves of New York.
Slaves of New York has nothing to do with The Color Purple, despite the titles. Ladies and gentlemen, I beg you, when it shows up in your podcast feed in 2 weeks' time, don't immediately delete it. We'll just shout out a few things. Bernadette Peters in a Merchant Ivory movie set in the 1980s art scene, and she makes hats.
Okay, that might be all there is.
This is an amazing, strange, singular, probably terrible film adapted by Merchant Ivory, known for their period dramas.
And, of course, Le Divorce.
We have read the book, and we will be giving you our entire take on Bernadette Peters and everyone else. Give us a shot with Slaves of New York. I have a feeling it's going to be quite an episode.
Yeah, me too. If you want to contact us, you can follow us at Broad Appeal Pod, or you can follow us on our individual Twitter handles. I'm at Sean McGovern X. Brian is at BA Mullen Speaks.
And even more so, if you haven't done so, and most of you haven't, Tusk, Donald Tusk. Tisk, tisk. Go on to iTunes, leave us a rating or a review. The more stars, the better. More stars, hopefully, than The Color Purple. And tell the rest of the world what you think of the podcast. It really, really helps spread the word. In 2 weeks' time, we will be packing some meat in the meatpacking district and wearing some hats with Bernadette Peters.
Oh, yeah, that sounds like a great night out to me.
We'll see you then. Bye-bye.
Bye.